Mercury's a part of the Earth. We have mechanisms and abilities to live with it. The problem is we just put too much in and we overwhelm the system. We think we get Mercury in our body and that's it. We can't do anything about it. It gets stuck. And that's not true. By far, probably the biggest increase of mercury that gets into our body from a single exposure often will come from.
Welcome to the Wiser Than Before podcast, where each episode will get a little wiser. I'm your host, Josh Dodds. On this episode of Wiser Than Before, we talk about why you may want to consider mercury toxicity if you have unexplained health problems, especially if you have dental fillings or eat a lot of seafood. Dr. Matt Reddy is a clinical consultant for doctors around the world to help them interpret their patients' lab tests for mercury toxicity. He tells us the surprising symptoms that can come from mercury, why almost nobody suspects it as a cause of their health issues, and who is most likely to have a mercury problem. Quick side note, even Tony Robbins unknowingly became mercury toxic. We talk about how that happened in the episode. We also cover which kinds of fish have the most mercury, which supplement you may want to take if you eat a lot of sushi, and how the mercury in dental amalgams can vaporize and be inhaled. Dr. Reddy also tells us his favorite lab test to show how mercury is affecting your body, and he even brought along a couple examples to explain what to look for. Enjoy. Dr. Matt Reddy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Excited to talk with you today. You were showing me tests for mercury, different kinds of tests, urine, blood, and hair. And we're even going to, like, most people don't walk around thinking I've got mercury poisoning or I've got mercury toxicity. So why is this something people should consider in their health? Or let me say this, who might want to consider this in their health? And why can it be a factor for those types of people I mentioned, chronic issue or just dragging a little bit and not sure exactly why?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's a bit challenging to answer really in a firm way. But I think when you're looking at people that are chronically ill, that have a burden of toxicity likely going on, then mercury should definitely be in the mix to discuss and figure out if that's actually a problem. Now, it may or may not be. I think may not be as dramatic as it, you know, in some people it is, in some people it isn't. But it's something to absolutely consider, you know, when people, you know, and who would really be looking at that would be people that are struggling with chronic illness, chronic immune issues, chronic fatigue, a lot of anxiety and mental health, and even, you know, cognitive type stuff is something that you really would want to explore heavy metals and particularly mercury with. One of the challenges, I will say, though, with mercury testing or mercury just in general is it can affect all systems of our bodies. So you can have people, you know, with maybe some sort of hypothyroid issue or other autoimmune thyroid piece, and mercury could be a part of that. Mercury could also be a part of cardiovascular issues. So, you know, it's tricky because it can affect a lot of different people and a lot of different, you know, aspects of our health.
Right. And that's kind of the trick with a number of these chronic health issues. Like, there's a cluster of symptoms, there's a lot of overlap, and you can't just, it's not so easy just to say, oh, this is the cause. Would you say that then something like a history or intake or kind of in-depth discussion with the patient or person can help point to, and if that's the case, what are some things I would point to? Hey, let's look into mercury as this part of the issue here.
Yeah, history is really the key piece here to start to sort of, at least the beginning, right, piece of trying to figure out this is what's going on. And I would say really the two main things to ask about mercury, and now there are others, but the two main things to consider are the intake of fish that somebody has. And when you're asking about that, you're actually looking at the, you know, the times, how often they're eating fish. Are they eating fish, you know, once a month, or are they eating fish every day? The other piece to ask around that is what kind of fish are people eating? Because this is the really unfortunate thing about fish, is that all fish have mercury. It really just depends on how much, and there's an exponentially different amount of mercury in different fish. So the small fish, your anchovies, your sardines, things like that really don't have very much mercury. They have a little, but not a lot. When you go up to these massive, you know, tunas and swordfish and these, you know, huge fish that, you know, sometimes weigh up to like 500 or 600 pounds, you know, you're talking huge amounts of mercury in these fish. And so by far, probably the biggest increase of mercury that gets into our body from a single exposure often will come from eating fish. The other thing that people really, you know, obviously many people are aware of and think about would be dental amalgams. So those are the silver fillings that were, that are still being placed by many lots of dentists. It was the only filling that was used for many, many years. Well, I mean, people that were, you know, born in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, even often all, a lot of them will have silver fillings in their mouth. You know, when you start moving into the younger people, you see less of that because of the development of other types of composites that can go into teeth. But it's still being used. It's still recommended. And unfortunately, and 50% of a dental amalgam, those silver fillings is actually elemental mercury. So it's, it can be a large, it can be a pretty significant exposure to people who have dental amalgams.
Yeah. I think that's sometimes challenging for people to wrap their head around, especially if they've had the filling for, you know, 2-3 decades. Like, this thing's been here for 30 years. What do you mean it's a problem? And especially if, you know, there's mercury used in labs and there's forms of mercury that, you know, people say technically it's not that dangerous, or as long as you clean it up and are you know, smart about that, then it's not that bad. One thing that really helped me understand this more is that video. It's probably 15 or 20 years old now, by a dental association, where they have a tooth with a filling in it, and then they apply different forms of friction and heat to it, and they hold it up in front of a screen so you can see the vapor coming from the amalgam. And it's wild. They'll put it like body temperature water on it, rub a pencil eraser on it, like, you know, like a toothbrush or a dental cleaning might, and you can just see the vapors coming up from that. So is it over time, even if it's a small amount of vapor, is it the case for some people that then gets absorbed and starts to add up and be a more meaningful amount?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, one of the things that I always educate practitioners and patients about is, what exactly do we mean by toxicity? And toxicity actually is the result of two things. It's the result of the source, right? The amount that's coming into our body. And then it's also the result of how well does our body handle that toxic substance, whatever it may be. I mean, we're talking about mercury right now. So, you know, we all get exposed to things constantly, you know, in our environment, in just being alive. So the toxicity, and we're talking really at the end of the day, it becomes down to the symptoms. Are you having all these things we started with, you know, the fatigue and the immune system issues and whatever else might present as? It's often a combination of both that burden that's coming in, the source coming in, and the inability of your body to manage that. And that inability of your body to manage it is really where the challenge comes in, I think, for these really chronic issues. Because, and you were asking, you know, how it is hard for people sometimes to wrap their mind around, I've had this for 30 years, it's not causing me any problems. And yes, it may not be, because it's coming into your system, but your body's able to handle it. Now, let's say something comes up that your body can't handle. Now you have this other aspect of mercury coming in. Now suddenly you've got kind of a mix of things happening, and now that slowly can build up and create a chronic issue. You know, and you know what those other things might be would be something like let's say you get food poisoning, or let's say you get a virus of some sort. These kinds of things change how our body manages different toxins. And so while at one point mercury might be at this, like, a level like two for toxicity in you because your body handles it. Now you put a virus or a food poisoning or other toxic exposure. Maybe it's something in the, maybe it's a pesticide or I don't know, something else. Now all of a sudden that mercury, instead of being that two on the, your particular toxicity, now it jumps up to maybe like a 12, right? Like tenfold, because your body can't handle it. Increase in 10, right? Because your body can't handle it. I mean, those are just arbitrary numbers, but just to kind of give you like an idea of really, we want to look at it as the whole picture, not just as, oh, I've got mercury, I'm sick. It's like, well, yes, you probably aren't doing great with it, but you know, there's a lot of other factors involved. And how do we make sure that we minimize our exposure, limit what we're getting in, and at the same time, optimize our ability to manage those exposures?
I think that's such an important point, because health is complex and multifaceted. And a lot of my understanding of health growing up was just like, you know, you're healthy till you get the flu, you know, or like there's always, it's just one thing, or you get the common cold, right? And I think with these chronic issues and this massive increase of chronic health issues we see in the Western cultures, that's changing, where it's not so much like, oh, this one bacteria or pathogen or virus causes it. It's accumulation of all the things in the environment, lifestyle, stress, and whatnot. And so in this example, mercury, it's just another, you know, it's another Jenga piece on top of the tower. And depending on if that tower is stable or not, it can cause issues or not. But that's, I think it's very helpful what you're saying, because people get a little confused, and rightfully so. There's one person can say, yeah, 30 years hasn't caused me a problem. Another person, 10 years, 5 years, it's an issue. Or the point you just made is like, yeah, maybe 30 years, it's fine, but it can be potentially a little bit of a ticking time bomb if you have a hit to health, and then that's just, you know, a little bit too much on top.
It's just another thing, right? And you know, look, and I don't want to make it sound like I don't think mercury is a toxin or a problem. It's a very big problem, very huge issue for a lot of people. But I also want people to put it all in the context of you know living on the planet. You know, like, we can't avoid it at all, entirely. You know, you're going to have a little bit of exposure.
Yeah. Well, one thing I learned in my own journey, just rebuilding my health from scratch, it basically felt like, was that that takes a lot of work. So anything you can identify that's like a bigger bang for your buck is really worth it. So, you know, in this case, if it is mercury, if, you know, mercury is a neurotoxin, mercury does some pretty rough things in the body. So, but I think this is the key, you know, for helping people understand it could be a piece, and then, you know, testing or what are the other ways for an individual to quantify or get a better idea for them, is this likely to move the needle? Because there's so many things to address. It's like, how, prioritizing is really key.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Prioritizing is really important, especially with these really chronic issues. And I think that's really where the test that we're going to talk about from Quiksilver Scientific, you know, really comes in, because it's really helps you understand where to put your efforts, where to, you know, particularly, you know, in the context of mercury, you know, is it a problem? Where is, you know, what type of mercury are we talking about? How is the body handling it? You get all that information from this test. And so you get a really good sense of, you know, how to kind of, like you said, prioritize, you know, where on this often toxic kind of soup of stuff we all have
right
to deal with.
Yeah. Well, perfect. Let's just use that as the segue. I know you have a couple examples to pull up, which would be great. Can you start maybe verbally by just giving an overview of the test? That would be helpful before we dive into the specific.
So yeah, I mean, full disclosure, I work as a clinical consultant for Quiksilver Scientific, which is a lab testing and supplement company in Boulder County, Colorado. We're in Louisville, just right outside of Boulder. And the company was founded by Dr. Chris Shade, who is a PhD in chemistry, really. It's environmental chemistry. His work was done in mercury and aqueous chemistry and all this really cool stuff that I don't fully wrap my brain around. But he, in his graduate work, patented a way to separate mercury into, because there's various forms of that mercury takes inside of our body. And he figured out the chemistry to take a blood sample and separate the mercury into its components, which is a very useful thing to do because you can understand then where the mercury is coming from and then how to, you know, like we talked about earlier, how to prioritize where and where actually to intervene if mercury is a problem. It's called the mercury tri-test. And we call it the tri-test because it looks at three different, you already mentioned it. It looks at blood, it looks at urine, and it looks at hair. And we look at all three of those things to get an idea, not only of the level of burden that somebody's dealing with, but we also look at it to understand how well the body is, like I mentioned earlier, handling that burden that's we may or may not have. So you get all that information on this test. So yeah, it's a really cool test, really helpful test. And it's the only test that does it. If you do other tests, other blood tests, they only look at what they call a total mercury, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just you don't get all of the information that you need.
Right. So what can this test, how can you determine the source, or how do you get more information about that? Because that, if a person has that, either if it's coming up on the test or there's, you know, clear history or symptomology where that might be possible, then the next immediate question is, well, where is it coming from and what can we do about it?
Yeah. Yeah. Should I share them? I can share a couple of tests right now. And we can
great. Pull them up. For anyone listening to this as a podcast and audio, don't worry. We're going to verbally point out everything we're talking about.
We'll do our best to verbally talk about it.
Yeah. YouTube or anywhere with video, then you can just follow along that way.
So there's three different graphs that we have on this test. And there's actually a table below the graphs. And in the table below the graphs, we actually have the numbered values that we measure. And these three things that we actually put on this test, we put a total mercury, but then we break that mercury into, break it into its two forms, which are the first form is methyl mercury. And the second form is inorganic mercury. Now, methyl mercury comes from fish, and it's the only source of methyl mercury. So when you're looking at this test, you basically have an idea of how much fish somebody's eating, because it's the only thing that will increase methyl mercury.
So there's no other way, if the form of mercury, methyl mercury, that only happens through eating fish.
Through eating fish.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And this is just an aspect of the environment, how mercury gets into the environment, gets transformed, and there's some bacterial transformation that occurs. It gets into the small fish, you know, into the, you know, really small food sources, basically, and then it compounds all the way up the food chain. So as the smaller fish are eaten by the bigger fish, et cetera, it gets more and more concentrated.
I was reading up on this just a bit to prep for our conversation today. Just like, how does this all get in? Why does it all get dumped in the ocean? Why does it all get dumped in the fish? And what I had read from EPA and some of these other sources was that mercury as an element can vaporize a little bit. It definitely does in the manufacturing process. So either way, there's mercury that gets into the air, and then it either rains down or lands in the ocean. So it's in the water, or even if it's on land, then rainwater can come and wash it downstream into the oceans when then the fish are swimming in it. Is that accurate at all? Or is there a better way to think about that?
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty accurate overall. It gets into the environment in many ways. You know, one of the ways is through the burning of like fossil fuels, coal primarily, but it also has a really dramatic increase from volcanic activity, just natural parts of being on the planet. The same with floods, you know, it's in the soil. So if there's any massive flooding in an area, the mercury can get exposed that way. So, you know, it's not only from just pollution from humans, but it, you know, that contributes for sure. It vaporizes, it's in the air, it gets rained down, it gets into the water. it's really this transformation into this methyl form that's really fascinating. And we don't really know exactly all the details of how that happens, this combining of the methyl group onto the mercury. But what's really fascinating about that particular molecule of methyl mercury is it actually mimics the amino acid methionine when it binds to the amino acid cysteine. So that's really how it gets into the fish protein. It's bound to cysteine. And that's a really common binding site for mercury in general. It likes that amino acid. And when it's in as cysteine, it's bound to cysteine, that's how it gets absorbed into our body. We absorb it really quickly, kind of like methionine. It sort of looks like methionine to the transporters in our GI system. So it's estimated it's probably somewhere around 85% absorbed right from the GI system. So it's massively broken down and just pulled right into our bloodstream.
Yeah, super highly absorbed. Because there's a lot of supplements that's like 10%, you know, or maybe like 40% would be really high. So 85%, wow.
Something like that. I mean, I don't know how they know that exactly, but that's one of the things I've read. Yeah, it's a point is pretty significantly absorbed right into our system.
And then, that binding is really interesting. So with this particular molecule, the methylmercury, when that gets absorbed in the system, does it, I don't know how to say this. Does it get then, you know, attached in the body or used? Is it a little more sticky? Is it a little harder to detox because it's taking the place of a, you know, natural amino acid we would normally have?
Not particularly. The challenge with mercury really, so this is a good question because it's at the end of the day, kind of a question of why is mercury toxic? Like, what is it doing that's creating problems? And what it's doing is binding to enzymes in our system. And there's a variety of enzymes that are susceptible to mercury. And when mercury binds to those enzymes, it basically inactivates these enzymes or dramatically slows them down. And when you have inactive enzymatic reactions occurring, you can't do certain things well. So that's really the toxicity of mercury. Now, it's not... In our bodies, it's not really, doesn't really seem to work the same as like in the fish, where it's kind of parts of the protein structure and things like that, at least not that I'm aware of. But it is impeding or interfering with the different enzymatic reactions that can occur. Methylmercury is actually fairly mobile in our body. We can actually move it in and out of tissues much more easily. It isn't quite as problematic in our system as the other form, the inorganic form, which we can talk about here in a little more detail.
So this patient, it looks like they're below average, less mercury than the average person in the population.
And, okay. You know, so this is someone that maybe eats a small amount of fish every now and again, but really you don't see a huge intake of methylmercury there. So you have a pretty good sense then that, yeah, methylmercury is not an issue.
And then can we cover the other kind of mercury?
Yeah, here? So the other is the inorganic form of mercury. Now this one has a variety of sources, but going back to what I was mentioning at the very beginning, the primary place we see it in most people is through dental amalgams. And what happens here is the amalgams, which I said earlier are 50% or so mercury, what that is actually what we call the elemental form of mercury. And the elemental form is what is that liquid silver, you know, metal that's found in like thermometers, old thermometers and things like that. That's the other name for that is quicksilver. So that was, you know, obviously the origin of the company, Quicksilver Scientific. But why that's important to understand is because at room temperature and pressure, elemental mercury will vaporize. It releases this small element, it's the elemental form of mercury. And you breathe that in very easily off of your dental amalgams. And once we breathe that in, it oxidizes, which basically means it loses a couple of electrons. And in chemistry, when you lose electrons, you've basically made something a lot more reactive. It's going to try and find balance. And in order to find balance, it tries to find more electrons. But in that process, it binds to things, it changes enzyme, you know, changes. And that's really where, again, going back to what I said earlier about the enzymes, it binds to enzymes in our body. And the inorganic form does that much more easily than the methylmercury form does.
So it's kind of like a double whammy. It vaporizes. Because it's vapor, it can be inhaled. When it's inhaled, it's oxidizes, and then it's a reactive compound.
Yeah. And then it becomes just more interactive with our chemistry. I mean, I think that's the easiest way to think about it without getting too lost in the weeds of oxidative reductive chemistry, really. I mean, it just becomes more interactive. And when it binds to things, then that's where you get the problems. And over time, and if that's happening a lot, now you've got, you know, potential symptomatic issues developing.
Okay. So on average, the kind that comes from dental amalgams is can cause more damage than what you get from fish.
Yes. I mean, then they're both extremely problematic, but you can handle a lot more of the methylmercury form from fish than you really can the inorganic form. One of the things, you know, to notice on this graph here, you'll notice how on the methylmercury, the graph goes up in increments of one. And this is nanograms per milliliter. But if you look at the inorganic form, it actually goes up in increments of 0.05. So by the time you're into the 95th percentile of inorganic, you're at about 0.4748 of nanograms per mil of mercury. As opposed to methylmercury, you're all the way up to about 7.5 nanograms per mil before you hit the 95th percentile. So a lot more toxic, a lot more reactive at much, much smaller amounts.
Got it. Yeah. So that, you know, that's another thing I found interesting about the test to be able to know, to distinguish the two.
Yes. And the other thing that to point out, and I'll show you an example of this here next, but the total mercury is, you just add them together. But because the total mercury, well, because the methyl mercury is so much more of our mercury burden, almost all of the total mercury is methyl mercury. Only a very, very small sliver of that is going to be the inorganic form. So if you have, you have a patient or what, you know, someone that has no fish intake or very, very little and has a lot of amalgams, their total mercury is going to look fairly low because there's just not very much methylmercury, but they could have a very significant inorganic burden.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's a very interesting point, because it just got me thinking, like, this is probably a question for a biological dentist or something, but how do they test, or if someone isn't looking at this split, what are ways they effectively use testing to get a better idea of what's going on?
It's a great question. Really comes to the heart of what the best testing for mercury is. And I think this is really where I want to do a lot of education to doctors, because we've been trained incorrectly for many years in how to test for mercury. And the reason we were trained incorrectly was just because we didn't have sensitive enough testing. And so we weren't getting the correct picture of how mercury actually shows up in the body. And it led people to think that mercury only shows up in the blood if you have a really big, big exposure. And if you don't, then it doesn't show up in the blood. But what we've shown here at Quiksilver is that, no, that's incorrect. We can actually see quite low levels of mercury in the blood. So you have to have the right type of testing of the blood, basically is what I'm saying, to actually see it. So what that then led people to do is do urine testing. And specifically, they would do what's called a challenge urine test, which means you do a you take a urine sample, they measure the mercury in it, and then they give you a compound called, that would be a provocation or a challenge agent, which is essentially a chelator of mercury. And they give you that, you take that, and then you test your urine again, and then they look at that to see how much mercury comes out and say, okay, all this mercury was hidden in your tissues. We gave you this challenging agent and now it pulled it all out into your urine. Because every single time you test urine after giving a challenge agent, the levels of mercury will go up without fail. It doesn't matter if you have a little bit or a whole lot. It always goes up. That's because all of the binding of mercury by these chelators, which is an excellent binder of mercury, they drop the way our body gets rid of those chelators with mercury is it goes through your kidneys. Does that make sense? So you take this orally, or and then you binds the mercury and you excrete it through your kidneys. And so it's going to just basically grab a hold of all the mercury it can find on its way to the kidneys and pull it out. You don't actually need the challenge if you have accurate testing. And that's what Quicksilver has really found. And I get nervous when people do challenge tests because I think you can stir up a lot of stuff and make people kind of sick from it. And they're not really accurate in explaining the level. It basically just kind of amplifies what's already present. It basically just puts like a 10x marker on every level of mercury that you might have had.
Okay. Is it hard to interpret? It's like clearly it goes up on the urine test because it just put in the substance that can bind to it, has an affinity to it. But are you saying then it's okay, great. So the level's higher, but then what does that tell us? How do we make good decisions from there?
You don't know what kind of mercury it is. You don't know where it came from. And this is my problem with the challenge testing is that the supposition that's behind it is that you can't see mercury unless you challenge it. It's not true. You can if you have a proper test. The other thing that they say is that it's finding these like hidden pockets of mercury and pulling them to the surface. And that's just incorrect as well, because these challenging agents don't stay in the body that long. They don't have this sort of longevity to seek and find and pull out and live long in the system. They're metabolized fairly quickly through our body. So, you know, they're going to find stuff and they're going to increase the level, but they're not really giving you the narrative is incorrect, I think, in using it. Now, I'm not, you know, if you want to show that there's more mercury, that's fine, but don't describe it as finding all this hidden mercury that you couldn't see before, because it's just going to amplify what's already there, and it's not going to tell you is all together, all the methyl and the inorganic is all in one thing. And so you're not separating out to know where it's coming from.
Right, right. Yeah, with mercury specifically, that's, you know, I suppose if you have a mouthful of amalgams, then you can, you know, there's a higher probability, but it, you know, that is helpful to distinguish. But this is pretty, it's fascinating what you're saying, because this applies to a lot more than just mercury as far as the challenge test and chelating. Different toxins or toxic metals and things like that.
I mean, unfortunately, mercury's really, I think, been like this whole challenge testing thing is really, really prevalent still out there, and it's just not necessary. The other thing that's really unfortunate about the challenge testing is that the challenged results, there's no reference range for the challenged results. They compare the challenge results to the non-challenge results. So it's basically just saying, you got more. Okay, great. You know, you will have more. You will always have more.
Even if a person isn't mercury toxic or doesn't have that high of relative levels.
Yeah. I mean, there's a pretty classic study in this. I mean, this isn't just, you know, Quicksilver making this up and saying, I mean, this is all based off of some research that was done. There was a paper that was done back in the early 1990s where they had four groups of people that they tested urine mercury levels. And it was people that had no amalgams, no exposure to mercury, very little fish intake. They had people that had a mouthful of amalgams. They had dentists who worked in mercury, you know, for, you know, 20, 30 years. And then the last group they had were these industrial workers who were using mercury in these facilities that are called chloralkali plants, which are probably one of the most toxic places you could possibly work. It's where we make chlorine gas, basically, and chlorine for swimming pools and lye and different things like that. It's tons of mercury in this process. At least the old, you know, there's other ways to do it, but that's one way that they would do it. And so their hypothesis was when they measured all the urine of these people and saw exactly what you would expect, this kind of linear relationship between low to low exposure, no, you know, none, very little in the people with no mercury, amalgams next, dentists next, and then the industrial workers last, and with the highest amounts. And what their hypothesis was that if they gave people a challenging agent, that because of the ability of, again, this is their hypothesis, that they said that the challenging agents would go in and find stores of mercury and bring it to the surface, that the dentists who had been exposed to mercury for, you know, 20 years would see this merging with this toxic, you know, upper end of the industrial workers, right?
Their results would start to match that level.
Because they have this massive exposure over time versus this massive exposure in a more acute setting. But what they actually found when they did the challenge testing was exactly what I mentioned earlier, where it just linearly went up. Everybody just jumped up. So the people with little had a little bit more, and et cetera. So we know really, when we understand the dynamics of mercury, is, you know, we can see levels in the blood. The reason that it was not understood properly was because the test didn't see low enough levels. And what does happen when you take, when you get a big increase of mercury into your body, like let's say you have a big sushi dinner or something like that, you go from where you started, like let's say you're at level, I don't know, let's say 3, and you go and have a sushi dinner, and now your levels go up to maybe like a 9 after that. If you measured about 24 hours later, 24 to 48 hours, that's what you're going to see, this pretty big increase in blood levels of mercury. But then over in the next 2 to 3 days, that level in the blood's going to gradually come down a little bit. And because the mercury is going to distribute itself out of the blood into the tissues, which is just, you know, absorption and just normal things like that. So you're going to actually see it drop down a little bit in the blood. Now imagine you didn't have a test that could see lower, right? So you've got this big high thing, you could see it in the blood, but then as it drops into the tissues, now all of a sudden you miss it, you can't see it anymore. And that's really where the testing was for a long time. It couldn't see low enough levels. It would only show up at really high levels, and it didn't account for that. So basically what people said was, oh, it moved into the tissues and it's not in the blood anymore.
Which kind of makes sense to me, just from, like, my one question I was going to ask you is, why does the body allow certain levels of mercury in the blood, just from the concept of homeostasis? Like, the body really protects the blood because that's coursing throughout the body, it's taking nutrients to all the cells. So it would kind of make sense if some of the stuff got packaged away in tissues and safer places. Mm-hmm.
Remember also about the blood, and you're definitely right, but remember about the blood, it's circulating, right? And as it's circulating, it's moving through our organs of detoxification, specifically the liver. In fact, that's the major thing to talk about with mercury. It's the liver. And it's also moving through the kidneys and, you know, to some degree, well, there's other aspects of elimination as well, but those are really the two main things that are relevant here. So you need it to, so if we don't take in any more mercury, like let's say we go cold turkey on fish, no fish at all in our diet. And over time, the blood, the tissues, the mercury that is in the blood is going to move through the liver and kidneys and get excreted. the cells are then going to mobilize and push mercury out into the blood to go through those organs of elimination again. So you can't get it out of the body unless it circulates. And so we have these mechanisms of doing that. And that's the other thing that I think often is misunderstood for people, is that we think we get mercury in our body and that's it. We can't do anything about it. It gets stuck. And that's not true. Now, it can occur that way. It can definitely be that way to a point, but it doesn't mean that we can't mobilize mercury, transform it. Now, all of our cells have the ability to do this, and the liver has a massive ability to do this. We conjugate it mostly to glutathione. I mean, that's really actually the biggest thing. We use glutathione, we bind it up, and then we move it into the blood where it can then get out. Now, that whole, if we really want to get lost in the weeds with mercury physiology and stuff, that's really where the problem becomes, because mercury damages our ability to make more glutathione. So you need glutathione to get rid of mercury, but mercury damages these enzymes that help you generate more glutathione. So you can see where you start this sort of downward spiral with a lot of mercury, because you lose, you're not alive if you don't have mercury, if you don't have glutathione. So I'm not saying you don't have any. I'm just saying it gets challenged to make enough and to keep up with, kind of stay on top of things.
It definitely helps to understand the mechanism a little bit, so then it's not just, you know, for people to link it to something too. It's not just like, oh, mercury's bad, it's here's what's happening. But I will resist. I'm very tempted to take us further in the weeds and ask more about what you just said, but I'll hold myself back for a little bit. Hey there, I hope you're enjoying this conversation, but you know what, I want to bring you even better content in the future. One way you can make sure that happens is by hitting the follow button on your phone in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever app you prefer. Now, if we're being honest with each other, you and I both know there's no way you're going to do this later. So let's take 7 seconds right now, and I'll walk you through the process. Pull out your phone, unlock it, and open Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the listening app of your choice. Now search for Wiser Than Before Podcast and hit follow. In Apple, that's the plus sign in the top right corner. And in Spotify, it's the button with the word follow just below the logo. That's it. You're all done. Doesn't it feel good to cross an item off your to-do list? Thank you for doing that. By hitting that follow button, you are actively bringing better guests and content to this podcast. Now, let's get back to the show. Can we move to the next section of the test, or is there more about blood we should cover?
No, that's good. Yeah, we can definitely move on. So the other piece of this test that we do is we do measure the urine, and we want to understand, we don't look at it specifically for levels of mercury per se. We're looking at it to understand how the body is managing the mercury. So, excuse me. So as I said before, with the mercury coming, it comes out both through the kidneys and through the liver. So we want, this test is a way for us to understand how well we're doing that. So in the urine, we measure we separate the mercury again and to the inorganic and the methyl mercury. However, there's really no methyl mercury that comes out in the urine. The only thing that really comes out in the urine is the inorganic form. Now, if you challenge it, if you do a challenge test, that's a different story. But in our test, if you're only looking at unchallenged urine with no chelating agent involved, you're only going to see the inorganic form. And what we see, we'll graph the results in the urine. We'll graph that against the blood results. And so we have this, it's a plot graph. So on the x-axis is the blood, and on the y-axis is the urine. And there's a linear relationship. So as it goes up in the blood, we want to see it go up in the urine as well. And that means that it's getting out. So the amount that you have is actually getting out properly.
Right. Okay. So there's higher amounts in the blood, and then blood gets filtered by the kidneys and becomes urine that gets excreted, then there should be similar changes in the urine as well.
Exactly.
Okay.
And what we see for a lot of people is that we'll see higher amounts in the blood than we do in the urine. And what you know then is that the body's it's holding on to the mercury a little more than it needs to. It's not excreting it quite as easily as it should.
Great. Not to take us in the weeds, but what's the next step for somebody if they find that's happening for them?
When they find that their kidneys are a little bit weak in excreting. There's a variety of different products on the market, you know, that support the kidneys and the kidney filtration and the kind of the drainage of the kidneys.
But even right there, so that would be the step, kidney support.
And,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. You do need to reduce the source, right? If you can. But kidneys play a pretty significant role in excreting mercury.
And in this case, if we're not doing a challenge, you said it's mainly inorganic. So the source, you'd pretty much be looking to the teeth.
Yes, for the most part.
Fillings.
Now, okay. Yeah, and just to wrap up the stuff about inorganic, you know, as sources, you know, the most common is by far the dental amalgams, but any exposure to the elemental form of mercury will give you some inorganic exposure. So if you had if you're working in a lab, you know, a chemistry lab, and there's mercury you're using, you're going to get exposed to the vapor, things like that. Or if you're in different industries, like those chloralkali workers are using elemental mercury, so they're just breathing in all this mercury vapor all the time. Stuff like that. Those are
coal burning too?
To some degree. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
You'll see some of that in the environment, in the air. One that we don't see too much in the United States, but is actually not uncommon around the world, is mercury is used in the gold mining process, particularly in what they call, I think they have a term they call like the artisanal gold miners, which basically just means these people that live near gold, rich soils that aren't part of big mining companies. And they basically dig up this dirt, they add mercury to the to it. And what happens is mercury binds to the gold. It's very good at binding to gold. And so then what they do is they actually heat up the amalgamized gold mercury mixture, and the mercury vaporizes off, and what they're left with is gold.
Wow. They're paying for that, for their whatever they're earning.
Oh, for sure. It's awful. Awful exposure. But they're, you know, it's really not that uncommon all around the world for people. So
when I was reading some of those articles I mentioned, I came across a Australian government website, and I guess they had some mining areas, and it talks about that process and why mercury is in the water. And they even said, you know, freshwater fish like trout and things you wouldn't, you know, they're not seafood, seawater fish, but in those areas have high mercury content. People need to watch out for it.
Yeah. And, you know, and what I described is a very like rudimentary form of doing that, which is still really common, but there are some more larger scale mines. Like I know in Australia, they do it, using mercury, with larger scale things. So, I mean, really the point is any exposure you have to the elemental form of mercury will give you the inorganic. So when you look at these graphs of the excretion pathways, you see a blue square, which is where the two values come together, the blood and the urine. And there's a black line of that linear relationship. As it goes up in the blood, it should go up in the urine. And that black line reflects that rise, that natural, that excretion, optimal excretion path about ability. And so you should see your blue square on that black line or above it, you know, which would mean higher in the urine than in the blood. That would be great if you saw that. But most people, you know, who have a problem, it's going to be higher in the blood than it is in the urine.
Which again means body holding on or not excreting as much as it could.
Yep.
Okay.
And then the hair, we look at the hair results to understand the excretion of the methylmercury. Methylmercury is excreted through the liver, specifically moving through the bile flow that the liver does. So the liver makes about, a quart or so of bile every day. And that bile carries out toxins, one of its jobs. And it carries the mercury with it into your GI system where you can excrete it in the stool. Now, we can't really measure the stool for mercury. It's just too much other stuff going on. And we can't measure bile, right, directly for mercury. So the hair has been shown very clearly to be a very good correlative marker for that. So as it goes up in the blood, we should see it go up in the hair. And again, you're going to see the x-axis is the blood level of methylmercury. The y-axis is the hair level of mercury. And then you'll see a blue square where they come together. And again, it should be on or above that black line.
And same concept as the urine. If there's more mercury in the blood, then if the person's excreting it, they would see more in the hair.
Yes. And so you'll see a lot of people that will have it again in in the red area on the graph, where it means it goes up in the blood, but it's not coming out as easily in the through the hair, which tells us that the liver needs some support. So you'd need to do bile flow support, liver support, GI support, stuff like that. So
do you have a couple other examples with things that with people are dealing with mercury issues?
So this was a really interesting case. This was a patient that ate halibut and salmon, and I think some tuna pretty regularly, like probably like every day or maybe even twice a day. Fish was a huge part of their diet. And so you'll see this level of methylmercury is nearly 22, which is, seven is basically our 95th percentile. So it's like three times higher than our 95th percentile. So it's just a massive amount of mercury. Yeah. That this woman had, and you'll also notice then on this one that the inorganic level is all the way up to nearly one. It's at 0.969. So that level is just, significant toxic burden. This is one of the highest ones I've seen in a long time in doing the consulting for this. And this woman did have some dental amalgams, which was contributing to this. One of the other things that we see sometimes is that the methylmercury will lose, will get converted into the inorganic form too. So when you have a massive amount of methylmercury, some of that you can lose that methyl group that's attached, and that becomes inorganic at that point.
Okay. I was going to ask, because for anyone listening, the chart, it shows her first test in 2020 and then about 3 years later, a second test. And yeah, the numbers just shoot off the chart, which would make sense for the first kind if she's eating more fish or especially these large predator fish that contain more mercury. That makes sense. But both mercuries went up. So unless she got more amalgam fillings, I was wondering how that went up, but that would make sense, I guess, if it can convert.
It's the conversion most likely, but you're right. I mean, there could be some other source. Maybe there's some other exposure she had, but I doubt she had more amalgams put in. I think this was just a increase from the fish. Yeah.
Do you remember the symptoms or any, case points just for anyone listening that wonders if this relates to them?
There was a lot of fatigue and cognitive issues in this woman.
I remember Tony Robbins.
Yes.
Essentially gave himself mercury poisoning, apparently. So this is a guy who's super into health and fitness. He has, all the resources and money you could want to put in it to be healthy.
Yeah.
And so at that time he thought he was being healthy. I think it was swordfish. He's literally eating it like every meal for years and years and just destroyed his health. So even, billionaires or people with all the money in the world, we can still get ourselves into trouble. Not knowing the principles. Or what was interesting for me about that is like he had the best of intentions. And I meet so many people who have the best of intentions. They just want to be healthy, eat healthy, just take care of their body, enjoy life more. And then they're like, how did I end up here? So It's good information to know.
Yeah, he talks about that in his more recent book. And Quiksilver was actually the company that did the testing. He talks about that as well. And I've seen his test and it was insane, like the amount of mercury that was. I mean, this one right here we're looking at is one of the highest ones I've seen in a while, but his was even more than this. I mean, it would, Josh, it probably would have killed you and I. I mean, literally, like that's how much.
That's what I was just thinking. Yeah. He's such like a high energy guy, a large human being. So I could just only imagine what he contained before he got run down.
I mean, when you're as big as he is, you could tolerate, you can have more, but maybe at least he did. That's for sure. But anyway, yeah, Quiksilver actually supported him in detoxing and things like that too. So he's doing great with all that right now. But yeah, it was pretty crazy. But you'll notice when we look down here at the excretion pathways for this particular woman, you'll see that blue square is really, really deep in the red area. And that means that it's nowhere near high enough in the urine that it should be, the inorganic form. And so we know she's definitely holding on to mercury too. So some of that burden is her body's just inability to excrete it. So yeah, her level in the urine is at 0.946. And just to give people an idea, that should probably, this level of that's in her blood of inorganic would mean it would need to be somewhere around probably 5.5 or 6 to actually be relevant to the amount that's in her blood. And she's not even at 1. So she's basically excreting about 5 times less mercury than she needs to be.
Wow. Yikes. Yeah. So that can really build up.
So it can really hold, her body's holding on to it, and especially if she keeps adding it in, right? Keeps adding it in with the fish. And we can see that also with the hair. The hair is also into the red area as well. So yeah, it's just a good indicator here that mercury is a major problem for her.
Right. So then just to summarize, you've kind of covered these steps throughout our conversation so far, but it would be stop ingesting or stop adding mercury to the body, of course. And then you mentioned kidney support to increase excretion through the urine, liver support to increase excretion through the bile. Anything else you would add to that? We don't have to go too deep, but.
Well, the other thing that's really helpful for getting rid of mercury is binding the mercury in the GI system. Because the more you can hold on to it and make sure you don't reabsorb anything that's getting dumped into the gut through the bile, the faster you're able to pull it out of the tissues and move it through the liver and kidneys. And what do you use to bind it? Well, I mean, there's a product that Quiksilver makes called IMD, which stands for intestinal metal detox, which is basically this product. It's this powdered silica product that has all these binding sites for mercury. And so very, very, very strong binding for mercury. So if mercury is available, it's going to bind to to it. And that's going to hold on to it so it can get pulled out of the body. So what I really want people to get about detoxing mercury is that if you can use your liver and your GI system as the primary way to do it, your kidneys are going to be much happier and they're going to be more effective at supporting the process. I didn't say this before, but both forms, methyl and inorganic mercury, are moved through the liver, but only the inorganic is moved through the kidneys. So if you can mostly use the liver, then the kidneys can be very supportive.
The liver is a little more, I don't know, sturdy, shall we say, right? The kidneys are more delicate and susceptible to things like that.
Yes. Absolutely. Your liver, I mean, you can cut out 2/3 of someone's liver and it will grow back. I mean, it's that resilient of an organ and that strong of an organ. Not to say that we don't do a lot to damage it, but yeah, it takes a lot. But the kidneys, yeah, the term you use, delicate, is great. I think it's not nearly as robust and hardy as the liver.
And the binding product you mentioned, that is the mercury, does it need to be in the GI, like has been ingested, or it can grab it because it's in the bile and it'll just help it?
Both. Okay. Yeah. Kind of cool, actually. I think if people are, and I'm not recommending people eat tons and tons of fish all the time, but you know, hey, if you're going to have some sushi every now and again, if you can bind it in your gut before you absorb it, why not?
Definitely better than going through your kidneys.
Yeah. And it's better than having it absorb and then go through and get into your tissues and have to go through the whole process all up, you know, back out again, you know, if you can just minimize its actual absorption. Yeah. So yeah, there was a gentleman I spoke to a while back that had pretty high methyl mercury levels, loved eating fish, and was actually moving to, I don't know, the Caymans or somewhere. And he was like, I'm not going to not eat fish. I mean, that's what I'm going to do when I live there. And so I'm like, all right, well, here's what I suggest you do kind of consistently with all the fish you're eating, and make sure you minimize your exposure that way.
Yeah, but I really agree with what you said towards the beginning. Like, it goes both ways. Like, yes, limit, and also, you know, we live in the world and there's going to be some exposure too. And I really like, you know, people having understanding the solutions too. And I liked what you said earlier about, like, yeah, the body can mobilize this too. Again, not to encourage getting a bunch of amalgam fillings or eating a ton of mercury through food, but also not to panic, you know, just know that the body can do this and there's tools to do it. And just like Tony Robbins, a lot of people have recovered and improved their health too.
Absolutely. You know, we've lived on the planet a long time with mercury. Mercury's a part of the earth, you know? So we have mechanisms and abilities to live with it and move it around. The problem is we just put too much in and we overwhelm the system, or we have other things. And so, yeah, you know, if you can support it from both sides, then yeah, you'd probably be fine.
Okay. I know I've taken us down a lot of weeds. So do you have?
I got one more. If you want to look at this other one, I thought this was a pretty interesting one. I wanted to show this one. It's not the best example of what I wanted to show, but it's a good one in some aspects. So, what this one shows is, you know, somewhat elevated methyl mercury, not really high, but definitely like before. The other one was at 22. This one's at 4.7, which is right at the edge of where I know people probably need to start really paying attention to their mercury on this test. You know, when it starts to get into the 4 to 5 to 6 nanograms per mil level, I start really to want them to pay attention and minimize their fish. But yeah, the little bit of a methyl mercury burden here. But then if you look at the inorganic one is already up to almost 0.5. And so
it's in the red.
Yeah, it's up into the red area. And so this was actually a doctor that had already was really confused about her patient here, where this mercury was, why it was, the inorganic was elevated, because this patient didn't have any dental amalgams. Now, sometimes I'll say, are you sure? Like, I don't know. Do people know that for sure? And she was pretty sure that this woman didn't have any dental amalgams. And so what I think this particular test is some exposure through probably a mercury spill somewhere in her home or in her work or somewhere where she's getting exposure to the elemental form of mercury and breathing in these vapors, and it's building up in her system. Because it's not, I don't think it's high enough in the fish. The methyl mercury, I don't think is high enough to drive all of this inorganic burden. And if she doesn't have exposure through amalgams, then it's coming from somewhere else. So I thought that was a pretty interesting picture, because it wasn't the common thing that we typically saw.
Yeah, very, very interesting. It'd be even more interesting if, you know, she doesn't work in manufacturing or some of the first maybe more obvious options.
If I remember correctly, this woman was some sort of surgeon. So I don't know. Maybe there was some exposure through something at the hospital, or I don't know. Like we were trying to brainstorm ideas. But what we also see on this test is that the urine to blood ratio is really good. So there's actually a high level in the urine. So it's very likely that this was not a long-term exposure. It's probably more of a recent thing because her body's actually starting to manage it. Or, you know, it's her kidneys haven't been impaired or anything by the mercury because it's high enough in the urine. But so she's not holding on to it. We know she's not, you know, retaining it as, you know, like some people do. But where it's coming from is the tricky part. So,
yeah, no, but I agree. It is an interesting example because it, you know, shows something there, and then that gives you leads. Like this person is suffering with a bunch of confusing symptoms. Like that's what I see all the time in my practice. Or I just talk to so many people, and they go to their doctor, and they've been multiple times, and there might not be something they can be diagnosed with yet, or something like that. But they know they don't feel well. So in those cases, it's just golden to be able to, for someone to be able to find like a direction to go.
And this, yeah. And so, yeah, the thing that I recommended this doctor to do was to test the family members as well. And let's see if, because we've definitely seen that where there's been like all, like the mom and their, you know, three kids all had elevated inorganic mercury, and they found a mercury spill like in their basement or something like that, you know, which was super uncommon, right? That doesn't happen very often, but you know, I don't know. I'm old enough to remember, I had a friend growing up that his dad had a little jar of elemental mercury in the basement, and it's really cool because it's,
yeah,
makes these cool little balls, and I don't know, your kids, you're like, ooh, cool, and, you know, rolling around in your hand, and horrible.
Brings a new meaning to the term playing with fire.
Yeah, no idea. But you might, I mean, if someone had that in the house or something got broken or spilled, or I don't know. It's, I know that was the case in one, there's a particular family that I know for sure that Quicksilver tested, and it was, they found this mercury spill randomly.
Well, that would really be the very valuable, the high value of testing cases like that. Like, yeah, who's going to think of that, right? But then you can test and start to get the flag.
Yeah, you wouldn't have any, there wouldn't be anything specific that would drive you to that. But so,
well, thank you so much for sharing these examples with us. They're really, really great to see. And I know they apply to people. So that's my hope, is that, you know, people listening to this can get a better understanding of if mercury might apply to them, or if they know it does, and they have a lot better idea of ways to think about it and how to move forward, and most importantly, improve their health. So I appreciate you coming on and sharing all that and your knowledge. Where can people find more about you if they want to consult with you, or you know, hear any more of your work? What's the best way to find you?
My website is drmattreddy.com. It's R-E-D-D-Y. That's probably the easiest way to find me. I am on Instagram, at Dr. Matt Reddy again. YouTube, I have a YouTube channel. I don't really have much on it at the moment, but yeah, it's the same Dr. Matt Reddy.
All right. Well, you might be, if anyone has requests, want to hear more YouTube from Dr. Reddy,
yeah,
send him in, right? So he's got some material.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thanks again. It was a great chatting with you, and I really appreciate everything you shared with us today.
My pleasure.
Hey there. I hope you enjoyed this episode and that you feel you're walking away wiser than before. I want to bring you even better episodes in the future. One way you can make sure that happens is by rating this podcast. The more of you who rate this podcast positively, the better guests I can bring you. Since you and I both know you're not going to do this later, I'll walk you through the 10-second process right now. All you have to do is follow along. Take out your phone and unlock it. Open up Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever app you listen on, and search for Wiser Than Before Podcast and click on the show. In Apple Podcasts, you have to scroll down towards the bottom, past the most recent episodes. When you get to the ratings and reviews section, click on the blank stars to rate. In Spotify, beneath the logo and name of the show, you'll see three horizontal dots. They're just to the right of the bell and settings icons. Click those three dots, and the second option is to rate the show. Hit the blank stars and fill them in. All done. You can cross that off your to-do list and start looking forward to even better episodes in the future. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week even wiser than before.